I'm wondering, I mean, I could come in here and say, hello, my name is Georgina McKenzie and I'm a dentist, and I would be lying. Or I could say that I'm fine when I'm not. Or I could pretend that I am someone else, like actors do, in a way. The body doesn't really pretend and lie in this way. Or does it? I don't know. Is there a kind of somatic presence that we can cultivate? Can we cultivate it? Here's part 8 of this exploratory series on somatic philosophy. And today I'm talking to Merlin Güri, who's Skyping with me from Germany, and who just got out of bed. You can find this and all other episodes on philoprax.se, that's FILOPRAX.se. And my name is Miriam van der Valk.
Yeah, I haven't prepared anything for today's talk. I just wanted to tell you. I don't even have questions. Like, I don't know.
Well, that's great because I didn't really either. I mean, I did think about it and I listened to some of the other talks that you've done, mostly the one with Karen. And then I don't know. I think I have enough, like, sort of an idea. And it's like it's almost fortunate that you catch me sort of just after getting up, because that's usually where my mind comes up with these really interesting, strange ideas.
I was thinking, you said 10 was too early, but that was because you were in bed. I was thinking sort of, man, what time do you get up? You said you, I know you're an ENFP, so I was thinking what stage would you be in? But this, so you just got up and this is your extroverted intuition.
Yeah, I got up like maybe like I woke up about an hour ago, and I can't really attribute if it's like autism or if it's any of the other things, but my sleep cycle isn't exactly regular. So it varies like tremendously each day when I get up, and then my life doesn't sort of follow the regular rhythm. So sometimes getting up just means like opening my eyes in bed, and it might still be like another 5 or 6 hours until I leave my bed, because it is very comfortable. And then since I can do almost anything that I'm doing, unless I'm like working with clients or something, from my bed, like I can read, I can watch things, I can eat, I can write stuff, I can just grab my notebook instead of going to my desktop computer or grab my guitar. There's a bunch of days where I spend many hours in my bed just because I have no reason to leave it.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. This morning especially was very hard to get up, and I have two kids, and one is one and the other one will be 11 in October. Yeah, and the 11 almost 11 year old is here every second week because her dad lives elsewhere. So when she's here, I get up with her in the morning at 20 past 7, and it's so early, and we both really don't like getting up early. Yeah, and it's
Oh
hard
God,
to,
yeah, that would kill me.
it's tough. It's okay once I'm up. Once I'm like downstairs in the kitchen, it's fine. It's not like I need to go back up again and sleep. Yeah, but it was especially hard this morning, so that maybe it's something in the air, something with the moon or whatever.
Oh well, there's like that already ties into like the like somatic world that
Yes.
I live in,
Yeah.
because there's like so many physical reactions that I have to, like, for example, strong weather changes, like air pressure changes. And we just had a pretty big air pressure change. So we've had it really, really warm. And then tonight it dropped back down to -1. And because I saw that that was going to happen, I just knew I was going to feel like somewhat crumpled today, like it's just, I don't know. I mean, it used to be a little bit annoying. It still is if there's a day coming where I know I need to be very active and very like sort of, you know, intro, like extroverted and interact with lots of people, then it's not going to be good for me because it affects how rested I feel. But, you know, I can't control the earth. So, and I think I don't want to. Therefore, it's more about finding ways to work with the somatic response that my body has to the environment, and then maybe put a little bit less of importance on the external demands. Because it, like, at least to me, it seems like there's a lot of sort of pressure or stress that kind of only happens in our heads.
Yes.
And it's not very real, you know? And even like, well, my former professional field is very like dominated by deadlines and like, you know, high time pressures. And when I first started sort of looking into adapting the somatic model into my universe, so to speak, you know, then I was like, well, you know, nobody dies if what I hand in is a day late. And we're like tremendously programmed and sort of habituated towards making a big deal out of that because, you know, maybe we get a letter that tells us no, no, and shakes the virtual finger at us, or, you know, we have to pay a fee or something. But all of these are not based on real things. Nothing real happens. Like, you know, no one comes and like beats me up, or no one takes my food away or something, or just because there is a day or an hour or something that I don't do the thing because something else came up. And so, you know, that was necessary when a somatic view was adapted into my life, because otherwise you kind of go crazy.
And with all this meta stuff that we allowed to steer our lives, it's not, you said that it's not like they're going to beat you up or take your food away. And also, it's not like they're going to beat someone else up or take some, you know, it's not like you're hurting anyone at all by not doing
anything. Exactly.
And it's just these arbitrary dates, and it's very interesting, because when you were talking of what I was thinking was, so what part is important? What should you, what is the thing that you need to do, even if the pressure in the atmosphere, etc., or the temperature is has affected you. So one thing that I want to do is to be present for, like, the person I am talking to, or the client or the person I'm trying to assist in some way. I need to be present, and the presence itself is so, it's like 100% somatic. No, it's not 100% somatic. Yeah, well, it is, because it's about the voice and the look and the, you know, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think I do.
The presence.
And I think that's kind of, you know, that is the part that makes this really challenging. You know, when I was thinking about the questions that you asked in the episode with Karen.
What were those? Like, I don't remember.
Well, so it's kind of like I make a mental sort of map, almost like a mind map, of the thoughts that bounce off the ideas that you discuss in the, you know, in the talk with her. And then I like keep playing with those ideas later on in my head when the episode is over. And one of the things that came to mind, although I don't know specifically what that sort of, you know, reflected off. Was that there's this aspect of, you know, like somatic experiencing being a new thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's true in a way, as like it's a more recently defined field, like scientifically, it's, not been so studied under that name with the specific sort of scientific method and guidelines that we have these days. But when you think about it in other ways, it's like ancient, like because it is so much at the root of our experience that it would be like quite ignorant, I think, to say, oh, like any meditation practice, any physical practice, any like almost all things that have anything in a guiding function towards like how you live your life or how you interact with certain parts of your life do incorporate knowingly or unknowingly some somatic parts. And like it just kind of let me like it let me kind of like page through all the like different lifetimes that I've lived, by which I don't actually mean different lifetimes. It's just that a week to me seems like a lifetime, because of the way I experience time. So it's like, all the different lives that I've lived in this life, basically, they all have aspects that seemed relevant. You started the podcast with her asking, what does somatic philosophy mean to you? And I was like, oh, wow, that's a big question. And, then I was like, well, what does it mean to me? And I found myself drawing on all of these different aspects of my current life and my past, many of which are not something I follow anymore. So, like, for example, I used to be like from like early childhood on, I did martial arts, and I, became a trainer and a teacher later, and I've done lots of different styles and explorations. It was a whole like big episode of a big chunk of my life. But currently I don't practice anymore. I don't, do anything in that area other than a little bit of reading and watching things. And still the like 2 decades or so that I've been in that world have provided me almost with like a library of somatic books, like, somatic data that, because it was so strongly like the main absorption tool was my body and my somatic experience.
Absorption tool.
Yeah.
Yes, for the data.
Exactly. Like, like experiential data. And then I was like, well, all of this obviously needs to go into the answer of what somatic philosophy is for me, because that informed how I do now, and a lot of it is really, really unconscious. So what I came back with after sort of many deep dives into different areas of my life where I found these different kind of, volumes or collections of somatic data books and stuff, and oh, what's the word? Lexica. Then what I came up with was something really, really basic, and I was like, okay, I think that at a very, very young age, I remember asking someone what philosophy is. And it was probably like my grandma or something. And I remember getting the answer that philosophy is mostly about asking questions. And I remember that as a young kid, I really, really liked that because I loved asking questions. And later on, and like kind of looking at it now, having learned a little bit more about what that means, I think this sort of inquisitive nature that back then inspired me still at the root of what I would call somatic philosophy. So if you can ask questions of your body or your physical experience,
Oh, I love this. Yes.
then with that, and you ask them not with like a demand, but with this inquisitive nature that is also kind of at the root of science, then that is the practice of somatic philosophy. But at the same time, if you were to ask me what is my somatic philosophy, then I'd be like, I can't answer that. Because I don't know yet, you know? I might never know in this lifetime. I figured out certain parts, but not something that is like super complete. And I think that was originally something that deteriorated me, like that drove me away from a sort of philosophy online forum that I was in my teens. Like someone was asking me, so you're in this philosophy forum, what's your philosophy? And I was like,
don't use it word
I
like
don't know.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I was like, I don't think I want to do this anymore. So yeah. But yeah, I think that's how I like, that's what philosophy in terms of like what somatic philosophy means to me. It's like cultivating first, you know, in the basic toolkit of how to even interact with this medium. And that's what we kind of have to do in any field. And then just being really curious and inquisitive and asking for the what and the why in a sort of, you know, gentle, open-minded manner.
And wisdom to me is this kind of ability to see quite a lot and to see how things go together and without and it has a kind of, if it has an emotional component, it's a kind of non-rushed calm, like a timelessness or something. But obviously it incorporates time too. Okay, blah blah blah. So as soon as you should always stop a little bit before you get to the blah 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 bit, but I didn't this time. So backtracking, the inquisitive nature and asking of the body, asking the what's and the why's, that is incorporating a philosophical soma, if you will. But then there has to be this other component where you're actually drawing the map. And so yeah. how is that done? Because it's not just having more experiences, you know, or new and more experiences, but you have to do something with them too that leads to a kind of wisdom.
Yeah.
So how is the what's the process and the cataloging? Like, do you know what I'm after? I'm not even
I
sure what I'm
so.
After. Yeah, something like that.
So you know, I mean, that's like that's a wonderful question, and therefore it's like, now I have too many like things I want to say at the same time.
Yes.
Because first I was like, oh yeah, I almost never managed to stop before the blah blah blah,
yeah.
And I just like roll through that and like come to the next point at some point.
Yeah, see how I stopped and backtracked and summarized. I'm so proud of myself how I managed to do that today.
See, I just found myself a justification for that because I learned that I'm an external processor, so therefore I need to say a bunch of stuff, and often that doesn't mean anything, but it helps me find meaning within what I want to say.
Yeah, and then you can make a plan, right? With the
exactly.
Extroverted thinking. Good, so let's make it the plan.
So what, but to your question, you know, like how do you get from the like accumulation of data to something that is like a usable map?
Usable,
you know?
for wisdom. Oh, here's the word usable. I just finished a book review. I might have to rewrite some of it now, but it was a scientific, popular science book, but written by a philosopher. And at a certain point, he said that the why questions lead to stop being helping us, informing us about the world, and the why questions will then at a certain point just be a diversion from accumulating useful knowledge. And I'm like, oh, I just hate this idea of useful knowledge suddenly. But But still, it has to be. Is there another word? Useful, wise, like a helping. No, what do I want to say?
Yeah, you see, I mean, I don't have that much of a problem with the word useful, but I
Okay.
have a problem with the way it's like used, you know, because useful gets often so much tied to like efficiency and a certain set of value that is kind of inferred by more like by society and culture. And I don't agree with that. Like for me, useful means I can do something with it.
Okay,
And
yes,
you know, and then like useless is, you know, something that I don't have a use for. So I look at those a lot more literal.
Okay, yeah, good, yeah. I'll go with that.
So yeah, when I'm saying like it makes the data into useful knowledge, it's more like, oh, I'm just finding a way to like somehow organize it so that I can
Applying
do
it.
something with it now,
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
and then because otherwise, if there's like all these rendered data points and there's no connection between them, I don't get the synergy of having a big pool of data that can tell me something that is between the lines, so to speak.
Yes, and hey, you know, here's a really important point because Semitic philosophy is always applied philosophy. You know, it's never just theoretical. Oh, this is interesting. And this is good. This is a good point. Yeah, good. Yeah.
Exactly. So what's like, you know, what's interesting is that I can't really narrow down what the specific process is that does that. Because much like what you said earlier about, you know, about presence, there seems to be a lot of factors that go into creating that, if you will. So there's like one of my like favorite examples, and it's like if Karen listens to this, she's probably gonna like, you know, laugh because this is an example I almost always bring up. But it's just like, you know, to me it's like it's so fascinating. It's almost like I want to understand it really bad, but I still can't fully, or I feel like I haven't squeezed all of the information out of that memory. So there was a time where I was in like a gathering. I was outside with like lots of friends, and I was, you know, I was probably like 19 or 20 or something. And I was walking around with friends, and the point is that on the somatic level, I was for like kind of the first time in my life feeling to that level, like, you know, safe and joyful and accepted by sort of a community. And that was a very new experience that I was kind of, you know, happily like splashing around in and being just like super like fulfilled and like joyful. And I was walking along like this path on the outside when suddenly a friend sort of jumped on me like from behind and put me in like a chokehold. So the context for this is that we were both martial artists, and so we did attack each other sort of playfully on occasion. The thing about this memory was that at this point I wasn't at like an extremely high level of my martial artistry, and what happened was I had one of these like I call them like full body moments. So like I didn't think, my body just reacted. And I sort of threw him over my shoulder and like had him under me with like my arm on his throat in like a sort of relatively stable good grip. But what happened was that my mind seemed to catch up. Like I was like blinking, and my mind needed a moment to be like, well, what just happened here? Like why is this person under me, and why am I like holding him? And to me, that sort of reaction is somatic wisdom. That is my body acting faster than my mind. And that's why like I find it so interesting, because what that signifies to me is that somehow my body did do the process of organizing all the data points in a way and using them for something. And I do know from like my training and research later on in that field of martial arts and self-defense that your haptic feedback and your somatic sensory toolkit is a lot faster than your cognition. So you can respond faster through physical touch than through like optical assessment. And that's why I'm like so interested in this, because to me it seems to point in a direction where I'm like, oh, so I have to not do it with my mind, you know, and then I can use my thinking in the somatic philosophy sense to ask questions, but I need to not use my thinking for the really essential part where it is more experiential. So it's almost like, you know, there's a different kind of thinking, a different kind of apparatus that has a thinking function, but it's not my brain, it's my body. And like, you know, when you then look into the area of somatic intelligence and you think of intelligence not as necessarily like a level of capacity, but maybe a level of potential, you know, so like, yeah, okay, I'm sure you can have different levels of potential and that might vary from person to person, but still, because it is potential, it is also, it has a muscle function, just like, you know, like just like your neurocognitive functions have an aspect of, if you use them more, you're going to get better at it. No matter like, you know, what your potential is, no matter what your, where your like limit is, so to speak. And if that applies to the body as well, then that means the more I expose my body to different type of sensations and experiences, and maybe even use its guidance if I'm able to hear what it asks for, the more somatic wisdom, as you say, I can acquire. And it puts me in a position where I'm like, you know, if I'm already in the field of somatic philosophy, there may be a trap there to engage with the field of somatic philosophy mostly from our heads rather than engaging with it like, you know, from our somatic experience. So this is sort of like a long kind of loop. Does that make sense still?
Yes. Yes, it does. I've taken some notes and in the sort of I'm pretending I'm a moderator right now, so I'm just going to say so. But the presence and the full. You said that you started talking about presence, this word that we mentioned earlier, and then you explained about this full body moment that you had. And then we said the body knows before the mind does, and the body's knowledge is a kind of which means the body was able to organize the data points and apply them, use them. So the body's knowledge is an active agency knowledge. The body the body is talking and moving and acting in it. In that's the kind of knowledge that a body has.
Yes.
Yeah. And the mind's knowledge is not the same. Yes. So, but we have the place of thinking. The place of thinking. Wait, and then the reason. Let's say reasoning instead, so we don't have, because thinking to me is very linked with words.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
So the reasoning of the mind and the reasoning of the body, and we can see this. And then the more you put yourself in new positions with new experiences, the more of this kind of body knowledge you can acquire. And the reason we can call it wisdom is because the body remembers.
This is awesome that you like moderate through it like this, because it helps me sort of catch the things that I thought but forgot to say.
Yeah, good.
because originally what I was thinking is, so that's why I started with presence, right? So the presence part is that what is like also fascinating about this full body experience that I had is that because I felt extremely safe and extremely joyful, like, you know, like a lot of my resources were like, for the first time, like, you know, met needs and like feeling seen and being safe and being like supported. All of these things were what made me a lot more present. And so there was an important aspect for me to realize later on that all of these things enable my body to act more wisely.
Yes.
Right. So, and it's like, it's funny that way, because it's like, when you look at some of the philosophies of martial arts, for example, there's all this like, you know, famous movie quoted stuff about fighting without fighting and like, you know, not like this, what can often be sort of misconstrued as emotionless or neutrality when you're like in a fight and so on and so forth. And if you look at that from like a slightly different perspective, you know, from this sort of idea of agency within yourself and like sovereignty within yourself, then it starts to make sense where you're like, oh yeah, okay, so, you know, as like an adult, I'm sort of responsible for taking care of the needs that I have and replenishing all the different reservoirs that are there, which includes hopefully, you know, somehow creating a community or family, whatever, like a field of people that I'm in that is supportive, where I do have these feelings of being welcome and being seen and being like, you know, mirrored and so on. And then whether you do that externally or internally or both, that's not really the point, but all of these things do actually put you in a higher state of presence. And from that higher state of presence, therefore, you will be more able to access your somatic potential and intelligence. And so it then started to make sense to me once I understood a little bit more about, and I actually don't understand a whole lot about the field of somatics, but, you know, from the little bit that I did learn about it, I was like, ah, okay, so it looks to me like some of the, like, older systems of martial arts were kind of like secretly kind of hinting at this aspect of life, you know, at being like, well, there's certain things that need to be in place for you to even be able to access this whole body of knowledge and wisdom that, well, that is literally your body. So yeah. And that's where the presence brings me to, because the more present we are, the more we are able to, I don't know where this comes from, but like the word that comes to my head right now is more like, the more able we are to actually interact with reality rather than with like, you know, constructs.
Yes. This is, super interesting. There are some things that are required for us to be present. And
yeah.
In this presence, we can access the somatic intelligence. But certain things must be in place first for us to not, I'm just repeating what you said, basically, for us to engage in the world, interact in the world somatically and not just through these constructs. This is super important for the future Institute of Somatic Philosophy, because we need to know where to begin. And I'm thinking here the place of I have several little threads. So one is the place of psychology in somatic philosophy. And then you mentioned older systems of martial arts that seem to have to already hint at these ideas. And what I'm thinking Then is this book. I'm reading this fabulous book about shamanism right now. I don't remember the English title, but it's something like, oh, it's shaman, healer, sage, something like that. It's like three words. But in that book, he also writes about shamans in South America and warriors, ancient warriors who were said to be unable to get hurt if they had done something special before. Mm-hmm. Like they had taken away their fear, they had cleansed their like light shields, etc. Mm-hmm. So that's another thread. And the third one, the very important one, is since I have a 1-year-old and I can see the full somatic engagement she has in the world. So the question is, when does this happen? This starting to engage through constructs, and how can we help prevent it become the major the only road that people go down? I can see this. I can see this link to. Oh no, I want to. Okay, no, I wanted to say it's something mean about the 20th century. I've often found myself quite angry with the 20th century for going leading us astray in so many ways. But now today I started thinking we have to, especially since I'm reading this shamanism book that sort of points to we don't only need to heal the people around us now for the sake of the future generations, etc., but also we need to heal the past and the ancestors who are sort of still living here in some way, sort of maybe we're carrying them with us. So we need to heal them too. And this is like a quite new thought to me. So now I'm thinking I won't be so mean to the 20th century. I'm going to try and heal it instead.
You could sort of shoot yourself in the foot by doing it.
That's right. So that when we're born, we have this, we have a definite somatic presence. When I talked to in the episode with Kelly Pride, which is number 7, we also talked about I said something like a baby sleeps with its entire body. But and obviously most people do, at least when we sleep deeply. But for them, it's really obvious. You can really see how the total relaxation in every cell. And also they sleep, eat, poo. They do everything with the entire being. And then something happens.
Yeah, I actually think that's like a fascinating point because it makes me think about some of the stuff that I already thought of before we started talking, but in like a new light, and I hadn't actually made this connection before. Mm-hmm. But something that like sticks out to me about you asking like, so how come we like start engaging with constructs, where we start engaging with things more like from a mental abstraction sort of point rather than like physically? No, that's not accurate. Well, I'll just ignore that for now.
It's a civilization process.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the thing that I was thinking of is, well, two things. So I sort of identify that, or like it's a working theory that one of the, for me, most visible expressions of me being gifted that I hadn't realized before, because I didn't grow up knowing that I was gifted. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up knowing any of the things that I was, not with label and description. Mm-hmm. There was very noticeable this kind of commonly identified, like I said, lots of questions, extreme curiosity, and like, really being very, very invested in finding out why things are the way they are. and not just like almost like an unwillingness to accept when someone tells me, I needed a way to try. Like, I needed to do the thing. I needed to see that it breaks or blows up if you do something. And, you know, and then when I look at my life, it's like when I was a little more integrated in the like regular society, so to speak, often like friends or colleagues would say, it's like, wow, Merlin, it's like crazy. All the things that you've done in your life when you're like not actually really even old. Because I've done like several apprenticeships and like internships, and I've had a few different businesses, and I've never stopped trying things out, and I can't stop that. It would kill me. So the thing that happened there was like, I started comparing, you know, to people that I grew up with, and I like at some point in my life it was actually quite painful to realize that they can settle for something, or you know, just accept that that's what they'll do now or whatever. While I couldn't. It would bore me to death, and I didn't know how to keep my attention on something unless it kept somehow being interesting. Like, you know, there's a few constants in my life that were like that, which is anything physical and like music and art, for example. So they're so vast and so complex. I can always do new things within that field. And having mentioned martial arts earlier, I think that was also behind like why I jumped through so many different styles. Like I would get a relatively high degree very quickly, and then I would keep playing with that, but I would also join a new school and learn a different style of martial arts. And to me, that felt actually very different than when I first learned words, like, you know, like, and so to mention on the side, I'm also autistic and I'm also dyslexic. And so learning words was like a very kind of like almost physically felt experience for me. And it still is sometimes. I need to use a word several times in different contexts until I can remember it and sort of fit it into my vocabulary matrix. So I need different forms of engagement with it. And that to me is very like similar to any of the other, you know, experiential sort of learning experiences. So I think that maybe part of having that drive through giftedness and part of having, you know, certain aspects of the autistic experience being very present in my life, I actually have sort of had the luck to some degree to not stop engaging with things on that level. Because, well, at least that's currently my easiest explanation for, you know, why did I have to do all these things? Most of the apprenticeships I did were in something that was hands-on and kind of craftsy. And most of the work that I've tried has something that I can physically do, sort of. And, you know, I've like craved lots of different outlets, whether it's like rock climbing or skating, or I've jumped out of a plane with a parachute and, you know, like swimming, diving, all of these things, they have such a high, like, you know, interest level for me. Like, I'm more interested in something that I can do than in something that is like, you know, purely mental.
Yes, the capacity to take an interest. I read something about that at some point. What was it now? The capacity to take an interest.